Ahoy there! You're listening to Product FM, a podcast focused on everything you need to find product market fit.
In this episode, I sat with Nimrod Priel, who is the founder and CEO of Core.com, to talk about the challenges and the inherent pros and cons of Agile and Scrum methodologies. At Core.com, Nimrod works with the team in 6-week sprints and quite different methods, as described in Shape Up. Nimrod worked previously many years ago with Onavo, that was acquired by Facebook, and led product teams at Facebook following the acquisition. He's been agile investing and advising startups across the globe, and recently been focusing on his work with Core.com. Later in the episode, we talk about clever ways to go to market with different products, products for developers and SaaS. This is the only episode where we used tape recorder, so quality is not top-notch, but content is definitely worth it.
Startups, you work by Scrum, you have sprints, you usually those are go over 2 weeks, you have the run, like the show of discovery, planning, I know that you guys do things quite differently.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I think at some point you said maybe you do things for 6 weeks. So yeah, why did you choose to do something else? What do you think is like the root cause of not adopting Scrum, and maybe take it from here?
So this is interesting. This is an area where I had, I have very kind of solid opinions. They're very different from what I see usually in the market, and we have to train people coming in to think differently unless they came from a very specific set of companies. So I come from Facebook. That's where I really trained to be a PM. Over 5.5 years there, I worked with tens of teams because I was in this centralized sort of role where I worked with a lot of different teams. And very few, if any, actually worked at Scrum in Facebook. And this goes back to a few other teams that I know. And so when I started Cord, I sort of built on the experiences that I had that were very, very good and very different to Scrum. And by now I have a philosophy around it. But then somebody pointed out that what we do at Cord is actually very similar organically, without knowing in advance, to a different method called Shape Up. And then I read the Shape Up book, and it's excellent, and we adopted some of its ideas. I think the key problem with Scrum for me is that it's based on 2-week sprints, and it posits a question that is at the heart of what was wrong with Waterfall in the first place, which is asking engineers how long would it take. And Scrum asks it in a different way. It asks you to sort of set sizes, t-shirt sizes, points, cards, there's all kinds of little games. But in the end of the day, there's a moment that almost feels like negotiation between the engineers and the project managers. It has to do with how long does a piece of work take. I came from engineering. Anyone who came from engineering knows that it's virtually impossible to assess in software how long something will take. The best engineers in the world, there's this guy called, his blog is called Rants on Repose, a very, very well-known engineer, does this thing for 30 years. He said, early on in my career, my assessment of how long something would take me was about 3 times off. So I would assess things that took, between a third and usually, three times longer than I estimated. And now that I'm so experienced and so senior, I'm about 2 times off, right? Mm. So it just doesn't, it's a fundamental fact of software engineering. And that means that when software engineers are asked how long something will take, they sandbag and they think of this just as any other estimation or engineering problem, where estimation, the quality of estimation, the accuracy matters a lot. So it's hard for them, it takes time. And it just creates this energy in the room every 2 weeks that is almost confrontational. And instead, what we do is we say, look, we're building this thing, right? This this product is an analogy to, like, I don't know, a cathedral or whatever, right? We're building this amazing thing. We should just look at it every period of time, say 6 weeks, and not ask ourselves how long does something take, but ask ourselves what needs work here the most? What area here is underdeveloped? Where should we invest our time? And then just say, all right, let's start investing there. Let's sequence the work. Let's prioritize. Let's understand what we could be doing there as a shared project, but without asking how much we'll get done in these 6 weeks, without trying to pin down a sort of commitment to a certain set of deliveries. Just saying, all right, you know what? Sign up flow needs work, or we want to build something here, and let's sequence it. And then, because it's 6 weeks, there's enough time for engineers to do some research, play around with it, try and start building something. After a few weeks within that realm, they get more confidence, and they can tell you more confidently, you know what, I can see from here, this is what ShapeUp calls health charts. We don't use these health charts, but we take a lot of the sort of underlying concepts from it. We can see from here what work is remaining. We already fleshed the thing out, we built a lot of the hard bits, we now just have to, like, finish a few very, very clear bits, and having worked in this area for the past couple of weeks, we know what are we going to deliver. And so I think another take on this is that Scrum is a great way. It has the right motivations in place, but it's not the optimal solution to solve these motivations. It's optimizing for the sort of average engineer. And what I found is that really good engineers hate Scrum. They hate being every 2 weeks in this sort of negotiation position. The pace is too fast. It doesn't let them do longer term projects. It sort of over prioritized short term wins. And it really is good for sort of the more junior or starting engineers that need to break down stuff to really, really tiny bits and being guided. And then what you really want in a project management system is the one that optimizes for the happiness of senior engineers, and dragging all of the juniors up to that level rather than something that makes all the senior engineers sort of grumbly and optimizes for the junior ones. That's how I see it.
If we take a bird's eye of you in the process, you start with, this is like a KPI, right? Start from like a business KPI, and then look at, okay, like what are the pain points we have that correspond with that KPI? And you get, it seems like in the beginning of those first like 6 weeks or the entire 6 weeks, you get a heat map of what's happening with the feature, with the module in the product, right? Like, so after those 6 weeks, usually you go deeper, but based on your experience, is it like so, or you move to the next thing and say, we took care of whatever we understand, and then we move on?
We usually move to something else to let the changes sort of, you know, see what the effect of the changes were, right? So you sort of, you land it, it's live with clients, with users. That's the important things that Scrum got right, and I think are very important in any system, is that you deliver something that's user-facing by the end of these six weeks. So you can sort of let it rest, see what it does, tend to another area. There's always enough stuff that needs tending to. And then during these 6 weeks where you were sort of working on another area, there's data that you've accumulated, there's discovery from these changes, and you can go back and say, you know what, we got some of this wrong and we want to do another iteration there. Or, you know, it's fine and we can really move on. So we go back and forth. The second thing to say is, you know, we basically do the process you said. We decide where do we want to work in. And we do try and have deliveries during these 6 weeks. We do try and land, you know, as we start planning it, if we see an opportunity. But this is the really sort of agile way. We talk to each other. The engineers are immersed in this project for 6 weeks. They understand the why. There's a lot of opportunities, and we try and sequence them in a way that there's some quick deliveries early on, maybe even in the first week or two. But it's not regimented into a cycle. It's if there's opportunity, it's if it happens to be, you know, as part of the early discovery for them of this new modular concept or ideas within whatever we're trying to optimize. If they discover something that's very quick, they don't wait with it, right? They just launch it. And then by the end of the 6 weeks, we can look back and say, all right, well, we did a couple of things. Some of them were early on, quick wins at the start. Some of them took, you know, the whole 6 weeks to mature. A lot of times we would do what ShapeUp calls scope cutting. You had a lot of ideas on the table, but to get something shipped by week six, you came in at week four and you said, you know what, we're gonna really simplify and cut this out and like drop a lot of edge cases and deliver something that is a bit more raw. And maybe we deliver the more raw thing just to a subset of users, or as a test, or whatever, or we just use it in a sales demo to check it out. We see all kinds of ways, even if it's not ready for product, to learn from it and then move on. Over the time, over the sort of, you know, years of running this in the company, we layered on top a bunch of things that just keep everyone in this 6 week rhythm, which is a very nice sort of, it's enough time to go deep into something, but there's, you know, eight of these in a year, there's two per quarter, it sort of works with the quarter schedule very nicely. And we layered on top a few things. For example, we need time to plan the next 6 weeks, usually as PMs and designers, to bring something to the table, to look at the data. And we do it, of course, over the we call these blocks. We do it, of course, over the block, but also we have a week at the end of every 6 weeks. So the sixth of every 6 weeks is actually called intermission week. And it's where engineers can work on whatever they think is important. It is still, you know, it's not like go build a game in your free time. We encourage this to be impactful, but it can be tech debt, it can be an internal tool, it can be something that basically the PM did not say is P1, right? And then we also have two people at every single week that are doing what we call frontlining. And frontlining means these people are responsible both for on-call, if there's, you know, production fires or, you know, something urgent, and the rest of their time they devote to fixing small bugs, just going through the sort of bug list and the triage. And what this means is that there's always two people working on all areas of the code base, even things that they didn't develop, and, you know, just making it better, just improving quality. And that means that when we plan out the 6 weeks, we don't need to take care of and prioritize and think at the level of these tiny little bugs and, you know, assign them points and assign people to them. Because there's constantly someone doing that kind of like general sweeping and polish and whatever. It's two people, so they teach each other. It's a random set of people, so it makes everyone sort of...
So you rotate. It's not just like someone junior.
No. It's just a random rota of two people at a time. Two people is really important here, because as a single engineer, you can get stuck and not even know how to move. But with two people, two minds, you unblock each other very, very quickly. You teach each other the best methods. You make the whole team socialize with each other. You make everyone sort of feel responsible for the whole code base, because if you're, you know, if you have a lower sort of quality bar and you release shit with bugs, then it'll bite you. Like, the frontliners will constantly go and have to fix your stuff, and you will be affected when you're frontlining. And it usually sort of makes people, because they care about their team and so on, makes them care for the sort of level of quality. So these things we layered on top, we found to be very, very useful.
How do you rally the team around actual value rather than shipping features, shipping code? Because, you know, I've seen, in especially with startups, that it's just harder to organize, generally, that sometimes as an engineer or in a squad, you're just like thinking of a feature, and then you get into the rabbit hole of edge cases.
Yeah.
Because this is sort of like sometimes the engineering mind.
Right.
And you end up spending twice the time you would want shipping something that might not be the most impactful. And I figure, and I guess you might be doing work on that side, that you really need all the organization to have this impact-based mindset.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What do you do other than this method? What do you do to get everyone on board and thinking this way?
Yeah, I think that's it's a different topic, though. I do think it also is something that's easier to do when you have 6 week blocks than 2 week blocks, because the 6 week block sort of schedule lets you invest time instead of every 2 weeks in sizing up, you know, items, which, you know, always takes like an hour, even if you plan it as a 15-minute scrum planning. It lets you really sort of prep for and invest in telling a bigger story about what's going to happen the next 6 weeks. A bigger story about what are we investing in, and really build a picture of the why. So when we plan a 6 week block, maybe it's a new feature, maybe it's an area or a KPI that we want to improve and brainstorm on how to improve, but it always comes out as sort of a, you know, like a big moment for the team. It's the block planning. We have a social celebration around it. It's every 6 weeks we can go out and, you know, have drinks or have dinner or whatever. And we, the product team, the designers, sit down and explain, you know, what we found. What is the big area of the cathedral that we want to invest in the next 6 weeks? It's easier to rally people around that than sort of every 2 weeks change the course or change the focus or, like, you know, do a big talk and then end up with the work that you can do in 2 weeks, which really is, you know, not a lot. And so I think that helps it, the schedule. But then what we do is very much sort of, yeah, classic sort of product management workbook. We spend a whole lot of time on the problem space, on really talking about the problem. It could start with a KPI, or the KPI could be like a sort of lens to that problem, like, you know, activation is not high enough, people are not enough aware of our product, or they're not using, you know, this and that feature that have strategic sort of value for us, or here's what we heard from, you know, all the clients in the past, and we go and we show clips of user interviews, which today are on Zoom and are very easy to record and just summarize for people and so on. And then we really talk about, okay, well, what do they, you know, what do they feel as they go through it? What do they need? How will it help them? Why do we want to invest in it, et cetera, et cetera? And just stay for as long as you can in the problem space. Because what I found is people's nature is to go to the solution space. But the more you actually force everyone to be in the problem space, it suddenly becomes clear to engineers, this is a trainable quality, that there's a core journey here, and that the edge cases that they care about, and it's great that they care about them, that's the mark of an expert engineer, but the edge cases are just not common. And what we would be better off with is first learning by delivering something in the core journey, learning whether it matches, and then investing in all the edge cases. And just trying to, like, block them off for now. No, you can't add a second, you know, task manager into your configuration. No, you can't do this, you can't do that. And just, like, really cutting out all of the rare branches and finding a way to deliver the main experience and seeing how much value it has.
Cool. So moving a bit from right from here, from value first approach with engineering to perhaps the clients or the user side. With Core, you've been not really maybe having any huge pivot, but I think the value stayed around the same concept, but the manifestation changed, right? So you started without an API, and now you have got a couple of APIs. So what were, like, major milestones along the way, and like how did you tune the value prop and the pitch, and basically
yeah.
found PMF?
Yeah, so this was, you know, Cord's story, maybe for everyone who doesn't know Cord. Cord, which is Cord.com, by the way. There's a few companies called Cord, but we're Cord.com. It's a way to turn every SaaS product into multiplayer. Basically, we take the experience you know and love from Figma or Notion or Google Docs, and we give it in every SaaS product that you use. And we have two main constituents. One is SaaS vendors that want to give this experience to their users because it'll make their SaaS product in their vertical more, you know, successful. It's a great value prop. Users love collaborating in product when they can, and it helps seat expansion and retention and sales and so on. So a SaaS vendor like Typeform, which we partnered with, gives all of its users collaboration with Cord on the surveys that they create inside Typeform. And the other constituent is the end user, because, you know, the end user has to have great collaboration to prefer it over the ways in which they communicate today, which are Slack and email and so on. And Slack and email are great communication products. They just have one fundamental unsolvable problem, which is they're not in context. So I can go to, you know, a Typeform that I created or a BI dashboard or whatever it is, and I'd have no idea that anyone was there. What did they think about, you know, what did they talk about? Were there any problems to try to solve, whatever? It's all buried in some channel, in some DMs, in Slack, in the past, and I have no way to sort of summon up these conversations. So this is the reason people leave Google Doc comments in line. They never, you know, have a Google Doc and discuss it in like Slack, because whoever will come there will not have the context. So it's much better to communicate in context when you can. And so basically we saw from the very first day, the big strategy was that there's these two constituents. And now the question was, how do you plot the right path between them? On the one hand, there's advantages to working directly with the end users of these products, because a sales cycle that involves, you know, adding an API to a product is very, very long. And by the time you get to end users and you actually, you know, learn from how they use it and whether they benefit from it and how do they want to experience communication collaboration, you could spend, you know, a lot of months just on going through whatever the SaaS vendors want you to go through, like, I don't know, security requirements or whatever. And so we released this first as a Chrome extension, mainly so that we could iterate, you know, faster. And the Chrome extension has this nice sort of side effect, which is it's available across all your SaaS. So you can really see how teams start to use it when they can have the same mode of collaboration, the unified inbox across everything from, you know, Google Analytics, their cloud products, their marketing tool stack, their, you know, whatever. And when we did this, we organically got to users who are working in tech who happen to work in other companies. And they said, oh my God, this is amazing. I want it for my, you know, I want for all of my users, I want for all of my clients, do you let us embed this? And when they reached out, that just made the SaaS vendor sale much, much easier. They could see it's working for them and they want it in this format. And so that's how we sort of started landing our first deals with SaaS vendors. So, you know, this was always a part of the strategy for us.
It's a beautiful, almost like a bottom-up go-to-market approach, where you start from the users and then you climb up to the vendors, which I think is interesting, quite sophisticated, quite different from what usually is being done. And I guess that, like, then those SaaS vendors, they reached out and said, we want to incorporate you. So that's the reason you started with the APIs, or was it something different?
That's exactly that. I mean, again, we knew in advance this is the movement we want to do, and we knew there's an opportunity there. Mm-hmm. I spoke about the advantages of starting with the end user, which are mainly agility and finding PMF, which are just invaluable. And, you know, if you can have them, it's the best thing, and you need to use it. It's a superpower. Many companies cannot have them, because if you're a B2B, by definition, sells to enterprises. I don't know, you're doing finances for public companies. It's a very specific kind of finance work. And if you do that, you know, you can't get to end users really quickly. You have to start on day one working with public companies, right? But if you do have the ability to work with end users, it's just much faster to iterate working with end users. You don't need a lot, you need a handful. You can recruit them from, you know, friends and family, you can recruit them from your networks, you can find other ways and communities to penetrate and recruit them. And so this was an advantage we wanted to use. But at the same time, once you start working with a SaaS vendor, you get access to all of their users because you're embedded in their product and all of their users get exposed to it. So we always, you know, we say, look, we're learning from, we have a user base that's bigger than each and every one of our clients. Because once we, you know, once we have more than one client, that's it. Like we're learning from the shared sort of base, user base of all of these SaaS vendors. And that's just amazing distribution, right? So if you measure yourself by your learning on the end user and improving the product, you want these distribution channels. So the API distribution channel is just amazing.
Interesting. So when you said learning from this shared user base, and this just reminds me of a thing you had like last week or so. You had this tweet that went viral with this like exact hockey stick of, I think there weren't even like X and Y label. It's just like when people see hockey stick in the startup ecosystem, immediately it triggers something in their brain. But it seems like, I guess it was coming from one of those collaborations, and you get this huge user base. All of a sudden, you start looking for a partner. It's like, how do you sort of like tackle, or what's your angle for looking at the tons of data that you just get, just like in almost like in one day, this huge pool. It can go so many ways.
Yeah, so I think, look, our North Star KPI was always the number of active organizations, where an active organization is a group of people having conversations on, you know, inside their SaaS tools. And it needs to be a group of people. It cannot be someone sort of leaving comments for themselves or sort of playing with and saying, oh, I'm just trying it out. And it's not about the number of messages they have, because that changes by workflow, it changes by person's verbosity, whatever. That's not right now what we optimize for. We just want to see retained, actively conversing organizations. And so that was always the North Star KPI. But now you go on the very classic sort of, you know, Teresa Torres has these opportunity trees, which are an amazing articulation of this. And we at Facebook call them KPI trees, where you just go from that question. You ask yourself, all right, well, what leads to an active org? Well, first of all, at a minimum, they have to, you know, retain, they have to constantly use it, they have to invite other people, they have to try it out, they have to be aware of it. So you have all these sub-metrics that lead to each other and lead to the top-level KPI, and you now try and look at the data across these metrics and identify where's the highest leverage point, where do you have the most gap. And you'd find that with data, but that doesn't mean you'd find the solution with data. Then you have to lean very heavily into something that's harder for us to do, which is collect qualitative data and go and with the hypotheses that you formed with data. Maybe my hypothesis is the invite flow isn't working well enough, or people aren't aware of the power of some feature that is our aha moment or whatever, and you need to then go and again spend time in the problem space, find the hypothesis for why that is, what's interrupting them. And the best way to do it is talk to users. So you go and you find the users that didn't fall, you know, off in that point in the funnel, and the users that did, and you interview samples of people from both groups, and you talk to them, and you'll find all kinds of things, right? And then you go and you try and maybe measure some of these things, or try and release experiments and try and optimize for them.
That's it for this time. Thank you, Nimrod, for joining us. And you all are welcome to get in touch via Twitter, either with Nimrod or with us. We would love your feedback. Have a great one.